And welcome to Mundine's Truth Talking. And tonight we're going to be talking about COVID-19, from the frying pan to the fire. Now, people may ask, well, that's an unusual name. What's that about? And I'm saying, well, the frying pan is the COVID-19 pandemic, and the fire is the lockdowns, the economy, border closes, businesses closes, job losses, school closes, loss of liberties and freedoms. The question is, and this is what we'll be talking about tonight, is have governments made it worse or better by their actions? And of course, people helping tonight are my special guests, Joe Hildebrand, journalist,
hey, Warren,
opinion columnist, and TV celebrity.
Well, that's right.
We always wanted one of them in our show. Caroline DeRosso, of course, businesswoman, lawyer, writer, and a fierce fighter of Western Australian swans. And then we have Steve Baxter, businessman, entrepreneur, and Shark Tank shark. Steve will be follow speaker with me at CPAC Australia on the 4th of November, which election day in the United States. Details of how to get tickets are on my Facebook page. In my recent article in The Spectator Australia, I said 50 years ago, a mass transition of Indigenous people from work to welfare led to intergenerational welfare dependency and poverty for the last 50 years. Are we heading the same way with so many Australians in that, which is out there? And you look at the figures, by April, over 1.3 million were on JobSeeker. 3.5 million were on JobKeeper wage subsidies. The OECD forecasts 6% fall in GDP globally. Australia's budget deficit is 200 million. Australia lost over a million jobs, about half come back, but then Victoria went back into lockdown. Employment rates are expected to be over 13% in coming months. Effective unemployment rates much higher than official. JobSeeker and JobKeeper supplements have extended that. Now, I'll start with you, Joe, because I've been following you on Twitter and seeing some of your I only follow you because you get more abused than me, and I thought I didn't think that was possible.
That's right, yeah.
And from your own mob as well. That's great.
That's right. Extremists hate a moderate. And the problem is when you're a moderate, you get attacked by the extremes of both sides. I should just pick one or the other. But anyway.
That's right. I love some of your comments back. But anyway, Joe, so what do you think? You know, we just had Dan Andrews just extend, the emergency by another 12 months. So have government... really put us in a bad position, or is this the right way to go to get us out?
I think that the big problem with this is that you have a lot of people who are dealing with the COVID crisis as a one-dimensional problem. So you have obviously the medical experts, the epidemiologists, very rightly are purely concerned with the best way to stop the spread of the pandemic, which is entirely understandable within their field of expertise and to be expected. The problem is, though, of course, that epidemiologists are not necessarily economists. And at the other end, you have people warning of these catastrophic effects out the other end. You have people who have warned about the mental health effects of lockdowns, of isolation, of kids not being able to associate with their peers, for example, in their final year of high school. The Sunday Telly did a great story highlighting, a spike in or a suicide cluster, at least, in relation to one Sydney school and the peer group around students at that school, and warnings based on RBA data. And think about how often you get a mental health suicide forecast based on RBA data, which forecasts the worst is yet to come. We know that Beyond Blue is getting, I think, from a report I heard on the ABC the other day, about 75% of their calls are now coming from Victoria alone. Anyone who knows the population of Victoria compared to the rest of Australia knows that that simply does not or should not add up. And then the further problem, I guess, is the problem you have with federation, which is you have the states who are the primary deliverers of healthcare, of public health programs and responding to public health crises, versus the Commonwealth, whose primary function is to manage the national economy and, of course, to dole out welfare payments. So you basically don't have – there's not really anyone in the puzzle who has skin in both games. Instead of having a government taking a holistic approach and saying, right, how can we balance the economic fallout with the health crisis – you actually have two different levels of government pursuing two different ends. A federal government, which from the very beginning has been about suppression of the pandemic and suppression of the cases and flattening the curve, which was always meant to be the official national strategy. And almost immediately that unraveled and we saw the states going for an elimination strategy, either by stealth or effectively doing. I mean, it's obvious that's what they're doing. They keep talking about it and they keep going for zero cases. They pursued lockdowns that were way above and beyond what the federal health advice was, the AHPPC advice was. And so you have these sort of parallel tram tracks, if you like, which are actually diverging in two very different directions. And that, I think, is critical to the problem. And I thought your article was really interesting, Warren, but this is the thing. There is no one actually trying to balance the two. You've got one layer of government, which is bearing the cost, the financial cost of the economic fallout and basically bailing out the human cost of the lockdowns. And then you've got the other level of government who is enforcing all these lockdowns but not having to pay the bills for them. And that is, in a nutshell, is the problem with this crisis. It's being dealt with in two different ways by two different governments with two different priorities.
Look, you summed it up quite well, actually. Is the problems of federation, you know, and this is what is happening at the moment. Caroline, we have a saying because I come out of the pipeline construction industry, the engineering industry, and the saying was never ask a engineer to build the best bridge because he'll send you bankrupt. It costs you billions of dollars. This is what is happening when everyone says you've got to listen to the experts, and of course you do, but at the end of the day, the politicians have to make a decision about what they're going to do. Is this what's happening at the moment?
There is quite a bit of this, and you've got obviously politicians as a class are incredibly risk adverse, and because of the way that this virus has been politicized and in some cases fairly too. You look what's happened in Europe and in China, and there were some very significant or very catastrophic consequences on a health level and on a society level. So you can understand why politicians want to do things properly, because obviously they don't want anything to get out of control like we saw in the early stages of the pandemic. The problem is that we've got health experts who are dealing with a slice of the health issue. So dealing with the pandemic and sidelining all other health issues we have, in a sense. So, you know, the people who need cancer treatment, the people who have got chronic pain who need treatment, the mental health aspects and what have you. And they're focusing very narrowly on this COVID issue. So the politicians say to the media, say to us, okay, well, the experts say X, therefore we need to do X. The problem is that they don't think about all the other concurrent issues, concurrent health issues and concurrent economic issues, which go along with taking that X action. And the problem is that while you've got health experts that understand the health aspect and why you need to take or they recommend certain action from a health aspect, they're not able to advise on the economic aspect or other ancillary but equally important aspects that go along with taking that action. And I think that's why, you know, we have so many views in relation to the lockdowns, where the experts say, okay, well, it's the easiest way for us to get control of this situation if we just lock everyone down, we test, etc. It's the easiest way to manage the virus. Okay, well, it might be the easiest way to manage the virus, but is it necessarily the best way? And those health experts may not always be in a position to be able to know the best way when you take into account all those other things. And that's the politician's job. The problem is the politicians don't want to do that, because then that exposes them to a risk, because then they may not necessarily be standing directly behind the health expert.
Yeah, well, that's correct. And I bumped into Julie Bishop a couple of weeks ago, and she said to me was at a meeting by doing Skype, I should say. We didn't physically bump into each other. Okay, Asia, it's okay. Is that the she said that there was a polling in Western Australia, something like 98% of people supported the border closure, and 100% of people wanted to make it permanent. Is politics and populism really pulling into this, Steve?
Well, I think the number was 89%. Oh, sorry, Steve.
No, you're right, mate. I've enjoyed it. That's actually frightening. 89, 90%.
You're terrifying.
50% who want a permanent border closure. We've got some problems. Well, I think I can just go back downstairs and be with my kids, because Joe nailed it in his summary, to be quite honest.
I was going to say that too. Yeah,
yeah, very good summation.
Your surprises, Joe. Good.
Yeah, that's it. Look, I think we can, you know, in the spirit, I suppose, of how you broke me, Warren, we can hopefully take advantage of this in the context of the aims of this conversation, how we actually get off the welfare issue here. Because I saw an article the other day saying we will have increased the deficit by $800 billion in order to maybe save 5,000 to 10,000 lives. That's $80 million to $160 million per life, which is incredible to say that. If you talked in terms of saving lives on a road to build a highway, you would not do that. So, and it's tough talking about human life, because you have to talk about, you know, loved ones and elderly, typically loved ones dying. So you're always on the losing end of this argument. It's like kicking puppies. You're never going to win. But there's lots of things we can do, lots of things we have done during this crisis to make our lives better. I think the fact now we can do a Zoom consult with a doctor is just fantastic. Why can't we do that? What annoys me is there's no signals from government that the things we can magically do during COVID will be available after COVID. As an investor, that concerns me, because we actually have not invested in some of those businesses, because there's no clarity on the regulatory framework afterwards. There's things that we can do with respect to capital raising. We can actually loosen up capital raising regulations. I mean, why is it that anyone can bet $20,000 on a horse race but actually can't buy $20,000 in a private unlisted business, for example? We have some real sort of lack of clarity in the way that we allow our citizens to operate. And I think some of the easiest things that we can do to get through this, because there's going to be a raft of business disasters coming. We have the loosening or the ending of the insolvency protections that were announced back in March coming up next month. And that there's a cascade there that terrifies me, to be honest, because I think there's a world of hurt coming. But we can continue the good work that Malcolm Turnbull did with the NISA program, with the move towards Chapter 11 with respect to director safe harbours and other bits and pieces. So there's lots of easy things I think we can do that won't cost much, that are involve deregulation. Now, pharmacies is another place. I hate pharmacists. Sorry if anyone's a pharmacist out there, but I'm sorry, you're a little monopolist, and I really do hate you, to be quite honest, because you're a bunch of rent seekers. So there's a bunch of things we can do to make our society more efficient, and federalism is another one too. We need to align states. State should be responsible for raising the taxes as well as spending the taxes. I think that would take care of most of our problems. So I might be off topic here. Warren's going to pick me up.
Yeah. You're going okay. Look, the biggest you're right, because you know, because like yourself, I'm in investment in that as well. And I can see a disaster. We're heading into a massive disaster if governments, especially the federal government, you know, don't start pulling out some plans, and we get this, the state governments and that actually taking some of the responsibility as well. I just, they're in a really good space. All they have to do is, close the borders and we're fine.
The federal government picks it up with JobKeeper and JobSeeker, and they get to close down the borders and look like hard people to run in their economy. And they get some credit for curing or from protecting us from COVID. They have used they've bashed COVID with an entire economy paid for by somebody else. It's actually talentless. They've done nothing special. They've literally taken our economy and they've thumped a disease that most of us were going to, 99.995% of us were going to die from. And they want some sort of credit from it. I think it's actually terrible to give them any sort of plaudits, congratulations.
Yeah, and also in regard to the money, and I'll go back to you, Joe. They've doubled the unemployment benefits. They've done all this, and once that happens, good or bad, once it happens, it's very hard to come back from that. And so we're setting ourselves up for a really bigger disaster than the COVID pandemic.
Yeah, look, I think there's an argument there. I mean, to be honest, I support a permanent rise in what's now called the job seeker payment. I could not have stayed at the doubling of the rate, but I support the sort of the push by business and welfare groups and some in the coalition. I mean, I don't see how forcing people into extreme poverty makes them more employable. And again, I think it's simply a matter of mathematics. You have to have enough jobs for job seekers, and clearly that is not the case at the moment. But I do think there is definitely there's kind of the lady at the drive-through said in Dude, Where's My Car, and then I mean, you can keep paying these excessive amounts, you can keep supplementing the
I ran a bunch of guys. I'm a mad keen aviator, and I know a bunch of people who are Qantas and Virgin A380s and 747 pilots who are now packing shells, right? Now, I actually feel sorry for them, but I actually feel for the young people, for example, trying to get a leg up in aviation who want to be a pilot, because they'll be competing against an amazing field of extremely talented people. And because of our high cost of living and especially our high minimum wage, they won't have a single thing they can bargain themselves off against. They can't sell themselves cheap to get experience. So, you know, I think we should go the other way to counterpoint you, just to sound like a bit of a nasty bugger. We should make the minimum wage closer to the dole.
Yeah, look, to be honest, I disagree. I don't think – I think our future is not going to be – I think that is a false horizon, if you like. And you're a businessman. You know these things better than me. But my instinct is that, countries with tiny minimum wages aren't necessarily more productive. They don't necessarily have smarter economies. I think Australia is very lucky, very blessed to have a very highly educated workforce. We are very blessed to have institutions and companies where people can do extraordinarily smart things that, frankly, Bangladesh can make our T-shirts. That's fine. That's not where we're going to excel. China can refine our steel. But we can do things in tech, we can do things in services that other places simply cannot do. And I think, and they are going to be relatively high wage jobs. Interestingly, I think the highest growth industry in Australia is aged care. So that will be a growth industry, I reckon, pretty soon as well. But I don't think I think we can definitely be smarter and be more targeted. I think there is merit in what the government's doing in tertiary education. I like Twiggy Forrest's idea of making TAFE places, for example, and skills training, vocational training, business-driven instead of just designing the courses and then waiting for the jobs to appear. You talk to business and you say, where are the shortages? And you design the courses around the job shortages. The government seems to be doing that in the university sector as well. And I know that, as an art student myself, I know there'll be a lot of art students crying into their soy lattes. But, frankly, if the benefit of an arts degree is that you go around tearing down statues and screaming at people on Twitter, then I'm not sure if they're the biggest advertisement for how good it is. And I don't really see, and I'm a Labor guy pretty much, and I don't really see how making teaching a more venerated profession or making nursing degrees more affordable for people. I don't see how that is anything but Labor heartland.
If I can be the absolute caricature of the Monopoly, you know, the Monopoly character, the evil token on the front line.
So you're going to be yourself, Steve.
I started my first business back in the mid-90s, and I've often described the employee marketplace there as exceptionally compliant. We've just come through the recessions of the early 90s.
Yeah.
Everybody wanted a job. We've now come through this incredible growth of, which I like. I love the fact that our young people are very well paid with great jobs and they can pick and choose. But a part of me says they're entitled little pricks at the same time, right? Now, I employ some of those, so I probably shouldn't say that out loud. Let's get out. So we're going to enter that phase now where the shoe is on the other foot, if you know what I mean. And everything needs balance. We've probably been too long without these corrections. We've had an amazing sort of 25 years. So I that's what I think, that in order to get flexibility and to get growth back in the economy, we need to take the shackles off. The amount of regulation out there that stops you from employing people is mind-numbing. We have the opportunity just to do a Trump and remove regulation, just hole us, just take it out volume at a time. And I think employment is one of those spaces.
Yeah, well, come on, Carolyn, I'll let you jump in a sec. Yeah, jump in now, sure.
Jump in just on the back of what Steve had to say. Yeah. That whole idea of having that 25 years of growth, I think is part of the pandemic is separate, but I wrote a piece in March before we even went into lockdown talking about how we were heading towards the next recession. And then one of our biggest problems was that we hadn't had a recession for 25 years. And I kind of described the economy, here's the Italian background coming out of me, as a fruit tree, right? And occasionally you need to prune your fruit trees, get rid of the dead wood, and it's the same with an economy, because then that there allows new growth and new growth and you thrive. If you don't prune your fruit trees, you keep getting continued growth, but it slows down over time, it hollows out the middle, and we end up with all the kind of structural issues which we have now, including some of it's cultural, some of it's attitudinal, and then some of it's, you know, it's structural, like where you're talking about regulation and red tape. We haven't had any real law reform probably since, you know, well, tax reform, we haven't had any since the GST. We've kind of been playing around the edges, but no one's really done anything big in a long time. And I think we're starting to feel that they're play out in an economic sense. And that was already happening even before the pandemic hit. And I think the pandemic's just accelerated it.
Yeah, well, I'll give an example because, you know, I'm involved in small businesses. So I run a couple of small businesses, electrical services, commercial service, and air conditioning refrigeration one. We couldn't get apprentices. We can't get any apprentices. We probably get one or two people turn up, and then we tell them what their wages and all this type of stuff, and then they bolt. Do we have to, you know, and you mentioned it, Steve, as well, that we have to reform the education system, that you don't all have to go to universities and do arts degree and learn some of these courses that I don't quite understand what they actually do. Do we have to really say people, because my sons, I'll give you a good example, my sons are tradies, my daughters went to university, my sons have $100,000 extra in salaries. You know, but when you try and get that message across to these kids, they always, oh no, we've got to, you know, you're dumbing us down.
Well, he's the counterpoint I'll have to that. So I'm a father. I got a pair of 3-year-olds and a 7-year-old, and had a chap actually when I was on a trade mission in China said this to me. We were having the same discussion. He said, "Well, turn around to your kids and say, it's okay not to get a higher education. Say that when they're 12 or 13 years old." You'd be mad to say that, wouldn't you? I mean, that's a scary prospect to say. A safe route is that. I think the universities are not covering themselves in glory with respect to the standard of the education and with respect to the indoctrination that's occurring, and some of their commercial practices are just stupid. So there's a lot to work out there. I don't think we should save them because they need a good and it's a Carolyn story. I love the Italian analogy, but I like the Australian analogy. We need to put a bushfire through them, basically. That's the best way, right? So we put a bushfire through a university and see what's left afterwards. I don't think so. You know, it's a pretty common, a local topic here in Australia, a recent topic here in Australia. So we need to burn them out and actually see what stands afterwards to some degree. Education needs to be better. I've got a young godson who I'm trying to assist with his tuition fees and whatever he wants to do. So I'm having this discussion with him at the moment. So, you know, it needs constant reform and watch. We need to do something different because it's not working. Anything else should be better.
I'm in broad agreement with all of that. I would just say in terms of like, say the wage debate, for example, and Warren, you mentioned it, apprentices, young people, I think we do need to stop devaluing the trades, and I think that is a very important point. And I think the idea that everyone has to go to university, even if you're not particularly suited or interested in it, is a furphy. And I think it's what a lot of aspirational middle class parents think, particularly if they perhaps or their parents hadn't gone to university. They think this is the way to get ahead. I think that's bollocks. I think people should be proud to be tradies and blue collar workers. But again, the reason why apprentices, what happened, if your minimum wage or your apprentice wage, which is pretty close to the dole in the first year, kids are just going to say, well, you know what, screw this. I'm actually better off, instead of getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning and working 8 hours a day and getting yelled at by big tough blokes, I think I am just about as good off being on the dole. And that is the problem. I think apprentice wages could be made better. Kids don't think 4 or 5 years ahead. They just don't. They're barely able to think about what's happening next week. So I think you can make that more attractive. You can't really start an apprenticeship and expect to pay rent these days. You have to have parents who are going to look after you. You have to have a car, chances are. You have to be able to afford your tools. I know they put up a bit of money for that, and that's great. And then the other aspect of it is the regulation. You're absolutely right. We do have to cut red tape. Some of the awards or the EBAs that are around are crazy. I remember, you know, there was like when I was a cadet journo or whatever on the house committee, there's like a glasses allowance because staring at your computer screen might make your eyes bad. And I think when the SPC was in trouble or something, somebody exposed a shiny can allowance. If the cans didn't have labels on them, then the sun would get in your eyes and you'd have to have an allowance for that. And I remember doing it with the Qantas, and they had an industrial dispute a few years ago. All these crazy little things that were just tacked on and tacked on and tacked on to all these tiny little things and didn't actually matter. Most workers wouldn't even know they were there, let alone be taking advantage of them. So you can wipe out all that. You can cut that red tape without actually cutting the material income, the material wages of people. And of course, those wages are going to go back into the economy, and the lower paid workers and they're going to go back for the workers at the bottom who have a lower disposable, a lower discretionary income, I should say.
Can I take a shot at your structural part of your argument, John? I don't disagree with what you said. Earlier on, you said that our T-shirts can be made in Bangladesh and they're still made in China. Apprentices work in steel mills. Apprentices work in mines. Apprentices don't tend to work in computer coding and financial services businesses. So I think we need a genuine discussion that Australia can be more than just high-tech HR services. We need a genuine discussion that our traditional businesses, the ones that Warren mentioned he was involved in, the ones that a lot of us fight every day for. I'm out there like, you know, banging on Queensland government's door about New Acland Stage 3. The fact we're going to shut down a working mine with 160 jobs is absolutely mind-numbing. So we actually need to value those industries that need apprentices. There's one thing saying we need apprentices, and then it's another thing to sort of say, yeah, but we really don't like those industries. I mean, there's a fundamental disconnect with the message, right?
That's right. I just think Australia needs to play. I completely agree. Australia needs to play to its strengths as an economy, I guess, is what I'm saying. There's no point trying to compete with other countries who can do things en masse at scale much cheaper than we can in a low-skilled environment. Things like resources, which we have, of course, we should go for them. Things like a highly educated workforce at the other end of the spectrum, if you like, we should go for that as well. We should do the things we're good at and let other people do the things that they can do better.
Yeah, and also the other thing that was interesting, which this is what happens when you get locked in a house, is you see things that need to be fixed all the time. And if you see Bunnings' profit this year, you know, I think 90% of it is my expenditure I spent there. But one thing that made me think about this whole thing was I had tradies coming and going just about every day fixing things. And I was talking to Elizabeth, for instance. She's in a law firm, and they're all too scared to go to work. They're all, you know, we can't come to work. Someone will get sick and they'll die. I this is the one thing that I can't understand. Every time you talk about the economy, and I've had this happen to me, and I've seen it happen to you, Joe, as well. As soon as you talk about that, they say, "What are you going to murder my grandmother?" something. Yeah, and you sit there and you go, wait a minute, fellas. Yeah. You know, if you have that attitude, we'd ban cars. Because they, people
you think no one had ever died ever before in the history of humankind. But,
what is happening? This is the thing that concerns me, because when we get through this, and we'll get through it, but what are we going to look like at the end of it? Mm. You know, what do you think, Carolyn?
I'm not really sure. I think there's going to have to be a period where particularly the government subsidy side of things is going to have to pare back, because we can't keep spending like we are.
And like on a drunken sailor in a port, as my mum would say.
And it's fair enough. The government required the lockdowns, and so for that reason, people can't go to work, people can't earn a living. You understand that there has to be a level of support there. But, you know, we have, and even Victoria seems to be getting pretty under control what they kind of let get away from them. But there is a point where we all have to start opening up. Now, Steve raised a really good point about the insolvency provisions. They're going to come to a point where they're going to wind back. Say for like a statutory demand, instead of 21 days notice before you're deemed insolvent, it's a 6-month period. So any stat demand that's issued before the cutoff date has 6 months. So there's going to be a few people who are going to be holding off on that until that expires to put their stat demand in to go back to 21 days. So all of a sudden the Federal Circuit Court's going to get really nice and busy. But then you're going to have that flow on into corporate insolvencies. That's going to flow on into job losses and what have you. And the problem is in a corporate context is that we've been kind of just been held up, and no one really knows what the actual corporate situation is. Bring it back to the virus. It's kind of like, well, if you don't test, you don't know how many people are sick. At the moment, because no one's going into external administration, and if you have a look at the current external administration figures, they are way lower than what they are on a normal year because, you know, directors, there's a moratorium on the director's liability for insolvent trading as well. So there's quite a few things that people are all just sitting there. People are all just sitting on JobKeeper. We're all going to see that wind back. The problem is for the government is that you can't outspend gravity, and it's going to get to a point where
I'm going to steal that.
You can't outspend gravity, so it's going to get to a point where it almost doesn't matter what the government does. It's going to get to a tinkering at the edges point, and we are going to have to see things open up, and we are going to have to learn to manage our outbreaks. Instead of just going, oh dear, there's a whole bunch of cases, quick, let's shut the shutters and wait for it to pass. We just can't keep switching business on and off. It's going to get to a point where we have to live with a bit of drama in our lives and a bit of inconvenience and whatever. But we have to keep things going because we can't stay on life support forever.
All these things that we've done to put ourselves in trouble, the root cause is the lockdown. The root cause is the overreaction to the health crisis. Yeah. And so to sound like
that's still the initial reaction. That's the problem.
Yeah. Well, to sound like the evil billionaire again who wants everyone to die, but essentially, because that's how it's going to come across. Let's hopefully we can make the conversation more mature than that. It's a disease that won't affect most of us. We've actually overreacted. It's an infectious respiratory disease. We will all be exposed to this thing, unfortunately. Yeah. I've got a 79-year-old dad and a pacemaker. It was designed to kill him. I don't want anywhere near him. None of these words bring me any joy. However, you know, if we're going to spend $80 to $160 million per life, how do I want that spent? I want security guards on old people's homes. I want services so that the elderly at-risk populations don't have to go to supermarkets. There's ways that we can do this that are a lot smarter. And it feels to me that we're just doubling down because of political reputations on lockdown, quarantine, and honestly things that have absolute no data or at least dubious data to their efficacy as proved around the world.
That's right. Mm-hmm. This is the other thing about which has come out of the pandemic is modelling. I grew up in the days we had, GIGO, garbage in, garbage out. The modelling only reflects what you actually put into this stuff. And look, all the modelling's been wrong. There's no doubt about that. And you look at some of the stuff that's been done overseas and you've got to say, what the hell's going on? I'm a bit kind to governments in the beginning because it was something we hadn't focused on or we haven't known about for 100 years. But in the last, after the first month, the first 2 months, we actually knew it. Joe Blow on the street could tell you what was going on. And you're right, Steve, it was the lockdown. The lockdowns and stopping people from going to work and destroying businesses. There are businesses that are not going to open up. They're gone. Those businesses are gone, and we know that. And
September is scary. September with that insolvency stuff, that's the next change for Morrison, because it'll take 1 to 2 to 3 months, mid-September onwards. That'll lead into Christmas. There's no way knowing that Morrison wants that in his watch. He'd be much rather push it in January, February, because that is going to be a bloodbath. It really is going to be a bloodbath. And I don't say that with any pride, because I've got about probably half a dozen companies out of 38 that, probably, lights out, fellas. You've done well to get to this point, but you probably need to,
fold it up. When Dan Andrews closed Victoria down, we were sitting at work because we have clients and that I felt like I was a counsellor. People were ringing us and they were crying because their businesses just went down the gurgler. They ordered gear because they thought they were going to move forward. They were stuck with all this stuff, stuck with all these bills and that. I sit there and go, what in the hell are these people thinking,
Do you recall back in the day where they said the comment, which is we can hibernate the economy? What a bunch of crap. How do you hibernate an economy, for Christ's sake?
That's a comment that if you've never run a business that you make.
Yeah. It's as relevant as monetary theory that we can keep printing money and hibernate the economy.
Yeah. I think
you got onto me, mate. I'd got a print and press out the back here paying me bills with you.
Yeah. I think there was that, and I'm with you, if you can forgive, Laurie Oakes had that beautiful line about John Howard. He said he made every single mistake in the book, but he only ever made it once. And you can forgive someone for making a mistake once. You can forgive, that's why I can, you can forgive the Ruby Princess because you had, officers scrambling, not knowing whether it was a federal or state problem, a massive screw up, obviously an enormous screw up with enormous consequences, but done, within a week of new rules being applied about overseas passenger arrivals and no one quite knowing what the new rules were, people being confused about flu tests versus COVID tests, the passenger manifest, someone not sending their bloody email from the ship's doctor's, Hotmail inbox. God forbid. Anyway, but we should know that. We knew a new March house. We knew that was a catastrophe. And again, it is not just on Dan Andrews, but it's also on the federal government's plate that the lessons there were clearly simply not learned and not passed on. And that is equally unforgivable. So the reason I'm so harsh on both Dan Andrews' second wave lockdown and also the aged care stuff as well, is that these were not mistakes that we did not know about. These were not problems that we were not aware of. These were problems that were writ large in the first wave that everyone should have known were catastrophes waiting to happen. And I think what is particularly galling is this idea that lockdowns are inevitable or that it's the disease that is perpetuating all this economic and social pain. I mean, these are decisions that are made by governments in response to the pandemic. Let's not pretend that these lockdowns are happening organically, that the disease is running around signing emergency orders. These are things we're deciding to do. The merits of those can be debated, but this is not an inevitability. And when it's being done, and there's an argument for those sort of lockdowns when we didn't know what we were dealing with, as you say, was. But when we knew exactly what we were dealing with, when we knew how critical it was, for example, to quarantine overseas international arrivals, and the very, very basic things were not done, the most fundamental basic things were not done, to the point of, kids smearing human waste in hotel rooms and then being walked around the hotel and outside, to countless other of these examples. Lack of training, security guards, not taking.
Can I have issue with that? But how often do you need to tell a security guard or a quarantine facility don't go near the infected people. Right.
Yeah.
You're done.
Look. You might say that, but I guess
don't have sex with them.
Don't buy them drugs.
Which apparently isn't obvious.
I've got a new career now. I'm going to become a security guard. This is great.
No, I'm going to become an interstate handbag shoplifter is my new speciality.
That is amazing as well. Look, sure, people should have used their common sense, but again, if you're a security guard, you've got no training even as a security guard, as some of these people didn't even have. It's not like they're actually the best in the world and there's not a SWAT team being flown in and saying, all right, guys, here you go, use your common sense. These are people who are being plucked out of apparently some diversity program or whatever it may have been, who didn't really necessarily have the skills to even be security guards. Private security guards, we know, have nowhere near the amount of training of cops. Yeah. You've got families who are freaked out. They've just got off a plane. They've got kids screaming. They can't go outside. You've got smokers who can't even have a bloody cigarette who are losing their minds, threatening suicide, screaming, threatening self-harm, all these sorts of things. Anyone who's just been plucked off the street, had a badge whacked on them and said, right, you're a security guard in a high-octane quarantine environment now, you have to deal with this, is obviously going to fail. And the thing is that every other state, for that reason, put in the toughest and the best people, the army and the cops. And Victoria, for reasons I simply cannot understand, did not do that. And unbelievably enough, Dan Andrews' sort of socialist, neo-Marxist followers all blamed this problem on neoliberalism and the use of the private sector, even though he was the only government who used the private sector when every other government was using the public sector incredibly successfully. So you have this crazy sort of weird reasoning with people. And this virus is, it's not just affecting people's bodies, it's affecting their brains. It's making people nuts.
And actually, on the brain thing, I mean, hasn't the state versus state thing, I mean, as a proud Australian, I carried a rifle for this country for 9 years for crying out loud. Very proud of Australia, but I'm a very, very proud Queenslander as well. But there's been some very disappointing things said by a very effective political leader. She's not a leader. She's a leader of a political party, and she's good at that. But our premier, that was disgraceful, the way that she's driving wedges for pure purposes of getting re-elected. And I think it's bringing out the worst demons in us. It truly is.
Well, this is the thing. This is the thing that I find lacking as well. I don't want to go around in circles, but it's, as I said, Blind Freddy could work out what was going on. So, I said, okay, if you've got people on a boat who have got some infections on the boat, don't let them off the boat.
Yeah.
An idiot would work that out
very
quickly. If you need trained proper people, and my grandson, he's in the military, he's in Brisbane, he was sent up to Brisbane and he's been working up there, But I just could not. I agree with you. But the problem we're having now, and this is what people talk about, but governments are ignoring it. Is what is going to happen? Because mental health. Look at the kids. I got a daughter going through high school, year 12 at the moment. It's a disaster. And she's just not coping. I'm going to get this is not helping me with my final year studies to try and get into university for my courses. All her school friends and across the school system, they got all that TikTok and all this other stuff going on. There's just threats of suicide and threats of people just packing up and crawling into a corner. So it's affecting young people. It's affecting old people. When I come back to the United States in February, I knew this. I said, better lock ourselves away just to behave ourselves. So we did for about 3 months. And I've got to tell you, in that 3 months, I just went down the gurgle. Depression set in. I had to fight to get out of bed every day. And I joke about digging a grave in the backyard, but it was almost coming to that. And I have friends of mine who are now in counselling because they've lost their jobs. I just can't understand how people are not talking about that. You know, suicide rates are going through that through the roof. Ian Hickey, you know, is a good friend of mine. He's a professor of brain at Sydney University, and he's just saying it's just gone berserk, and more people are going to die from that than the pandemic. And yet, well, no one's no talking about it.
The other side of the coin to all this, to our health measures, has got to be no one's balanced this equation. That's the issue I've got. Forget the monetary stuff. Let's just assume that we know what happens when 1% of GDP goes away. We know that there's a certain health roll-on effect from that, and economists do know that. Why isn't that being balanced against the other side of this? And it's not. And we can't have even that conversation. Forget the money. We can't have that conversation. That to me, the worst of us coming out, our political leaders sort of saying, this is the cheap, easy yards I can get to be a megalomaniac populist, if you know what I mean. And that I don't get that. To me, it's petty and it's evil.
I think that, yeah, that's exactly right. And I think this is where, like, a lot of people like me and others, and I know you guys, warning about this at the very beginning and saying, look, if you shut down the economy now for 3 months or 2 months or whatever it's going to be, down the road there are going to be these enormous long tail consequences that are going to be literally fatal. And we have seen that, and the warnings were there, and people weren't listening. And the problem is you're not dealing with two things happening at the same time. So you have all these people going, oh my God, it's here. We've got to shut down everything. And it's only now that the ramifications of that. And it is going to be when people, you know, people can say, oh yeah, we're all in this together, while they've still got savings in the bank, or before they've chewed through their 10 grand of super. And it, frankly, it's going to be the people who don't have that much in there who are probably the most likely to do that. You know, before they realize they can't make the payments on their house anymore, before, you know, they realize that they're the ones who lost their job, but they thought they still had it early on because the job keeper was there, or because the business was still limping along, and now suddenly it realizes that it can't keep going. It's either it's just gone dead in the water, or it's just realized that you can't come back, you know, trying to make a year's worth of income on 9 months worth of trade. And so now that all that is coming, now all those chickens are coming home to roost, if you like, everyone, I think, is starting to slowly wake up and going, oh, hang on, God, this is actually quite bad. There are these other things. And that's when you do get to that horrible ledger of deaths from COVID-19 or deaths from this ongoing slow economic and social decay that these lockdowns have caused. And again, these were not inevitable. These were decisions made by policymakers, often over and above what the expert advice was, and this is what we're seeing now.
We've actually got a blueprint for it. And everyone now knows how a farmer feels. Farmers will go for months and years on end without income, and still expect the bank to be paid and everyone else to be paid. And they have dreadful social consequences. The drought and the lack of, you know, the suicide rates in the regional rural areas are very well known and sad. So we've got a blueprint for this. We know what's going to happen. And so we've seen this coming. We don't seem to have taken our cue, though, which doesn't bode well.
Caroline, this is the thing that I get really frustrated with, is that it's all about, oh, we've got to save Granny, or we've got to save, you know, and they just trounce our civil rights. You know, I just can't believe, you know, they just put this state of emergency on in Victoria another 12 months. You know, police coming around knocking on your door and checking if you're home. You know, I have great fears that people, we're going to have a revolution, actually, or we're going to end up with all these people going mad.
Yeah, it's a little bit terrifying, isn't it? And the thing is, you know, I know Australians, you know, we tend to be a little bit larrikin and we tend to be a little bit laid back about things, but people have generally followed the rules really well. But our government's treating us like we're absolute children. And when you treat adults like children, they're probably going to behave like children. So I can understand why some people are starting to push back now, because I think a lot of, you know, the population, I think the tide has turned. I think people have, like Joe was saying, people have started to work out that, hang on a second, this, you know, this rosy little lockdown isn't all that it's cracked up to be. I'm in Western Australia. We've had no coronavirus cases for a long time. We get the occasional one from a return traveller, but they're in hotel quarantine. We've had, you know, we're on to stage 4 restrictions. We're meant to go to stage 5 restrictions, but they're not bringing that on until I think the 25th of October is the planned date. So we're not being able to have our royal show, which has since been canned, but the borders are still closed. So either let us do the things that we can do here if the borders are going to be closed, because there's evidently no community transmission, or you're going to have to open up the borders if we're not going to go to stage five. You can't really have both. Then they're talking about, you know, oh, maybe we can fill Optus Stadium for the grand final. Really? And I think people are just starting to work out that it is a whole big political game. And what we've seen in WA, and obviously, you know, the Clive Palmer legislation has been spoken about, you know, across the country. But there are plenty of other things that the state government here are trying to slide in under the guise of COVID. And so they put some pretty little name to a bill so that it looks all nice and innocuous, and then they put COVID in brackets so that we all think it's about health. And then they slide in all these other little bits and pieces to extend their power. So we had a bill go through last week, and congratulations to Peter Law from the West who wrote about this, that has got Henry VIII provisions in it. And essentially what that allows the authority that regulates that piece of legislation to be able to make regulations which are inconsistent with the actual act that's gone through Parliament. Yeah, that's really not okay. But we are seeing lots of these, well, some of them are obvious and some of them are a lot less obvious, things happening which are extending government power and which are restricting our rights. But we're all told it's for our own good, because if they don't do it, we're all going to die. And I feel like that story, it's starting to have run its course.
Yeah, right. I just cannot believe how quickly people, you know, and you're right about, you know, people have used common sense. The nuns used to cane me if I went to school and didn't wash my hands. They used to check behind my ears for potato patches and all that type of stuff. and so I was fine. Wash my hands and clean my ears, and you know, I don't mind wearing a mask. You know, I hate to see people sneezing on each other. All the mining industry is a good example. They actually had distancing on their mine sites and clean stuff. And look at the mining industry. They're making more money than you can poke a stick at. So why did they get away with this stuff and the rest of us all got locked out? I heard of a person who actually works in this company that one of the HR people had become dictator. She went around with a ruler and measured to make sure that the desks were 1.5 metres apart. And she found some of the desks were only 1.45, and those people had to go home. They couldn't come to work.
There are so many bloody autocrats in all of this, isn't there?
Finally, HR's come into its own. They finally have something to do.
Oh, this is what they've been planning for years.
I think I was just going to say, I think one of the lessons out of this is that the lack of imagination and the lack of three-dimensional thinking in Australia's leadership and how, I mean, the problem with, again, what's happening in Victoria, it's such a blunt force instrument. And, you know, you've got people blaming the easing of restrictions for the second one. I mean, it's so patently untrue. There's not a shred of evidence for it. It had nothing to do with the easing of restrictions. It had everything to do with grotesque failures in hotel quarantine, and then an inability to contact trace. And you can, you know, there's reports coming out as soon as it basically got to double figures, about 20 people overnight, they were swamped. They simply couldn't do it. In New South Wales, the opposite was the case. So even when those numbers crept up, they were able to find out who they were, trace all their contacts, and put a lid on it. And that's why we're not in the same situation as Victoria was. And this is because, Victoria has a largely paper-based health system with a sort of a central Politburo-style call centre, I'm told, from what I've read, whereas New South Wales has the opposite, where it has this massive sort of computerised database where everyone can access all this information, but at the same time it's got people in the local communities who are able to talk to and trace the actual spread where it's happening. And the best thing out of contact tracing is a smart solution that doesn't require a lockdown. Sorry, go.
I'd say the best thing out of contact tracing is the absolute rabid failure of COVID Safe. The fact they dared to try and electronically foot brace every last Australian has to be one of the saddest moments of liberty in this country with shit technology. Actually, the technology was the best available. But honestly, to sort of say that you might not be able to get a work or a restaurant unless you carry this COVID-safe app around and you actually proved it. So what, all of a sudden police are going to get search and seize powers to ensure you were using a bloody program on your phone? No one thought more than 3 seconds past that, and it was to a disgraceful, and I'm so glad it just went away as a dismal failure.
But that should have been an example of
we used to kill kids at school who were snitchers, and now they're all everyone's turning into a snitzer.
Used to kill them.
Well, not me personally. Other kids in my school did these dreadful things. But yeah, I just what's the new norm now? Yeah, we've got all this. We've got people scared of death. You know, I'm very sorry to tell everyone, but we're all going to die one day. Some may die sooner than other people. It's just when a teacher told me, which scared the crap out of me when I was at school, said, you're dying from birth. But, you know, I just can't understand, you know, how, you know, you get beaten up if you actually try and look at three or four things at once and try and measure that. And they say, oh, no, you just want to see my granny dead, or you want to kill
80 to $160 million is what we're paying to save a life. If you look at 10,000 dead, 5 to 10,000 dead, and that's what we're going to save. 80 to 160 million bucks.
Well, I've always been terrified of death, which is why when COVID came along, nothing really changed. I've always known it was inevitable. I never really wanted it to happen. And I think what we're almost seeing is the sort of opposite of this. And I think we've lived for so long in peacetime, so long since a world war, a sort of catastrophic event. But you actually, we almost now have a generation of people who even their parents or grandparents have never known a sort of mass crisis, a mass trauma like World War or the Holocaust or mass disease like that. And there's this, I actually think there's this kind of mentality that the government actually is obliged to keep me alive. I have a right to live forever. And it's the government's duty to protect me from death at all costs. And I'm pretty sure that's not something that any other generation has ever had. Tyler, I mean, you could go back to Vietnam, like the idea of Vietnam, you'd actually protest against going to war. But I mean, any other war before that, you'd be shot. But then that's now, you know, two generations away. This is something that we should all live to old age in safety, whatever, which is great, and I would love that to happen. But the idea that you should be guaranteed a life free from risk by your government, and that if the government fails to do that, it's a breach of its contractual. Well, that's right.
I actually refuse to use the words new normal because I don't really enjoyed my free trial of 1984, but thank you.
In 1918, 75 million people out of 2 billion died from Spanish influenza.
Yeah.
Things got back to normal.
Things will.
The First World War where people were killed, millions of people were killed.
Yeah.
And we almost need to make a list of all of our rights that have been taken away from us in the last 6 months or so that we can make sure we claw them all back eventually. Because the thing is, once you've got a population nice and scared, it's easy to take their rights off. But like the same with taking away welfare, it's hard to get your rights back. So I think going forward, there needs to be a concerted effort where we go, okay, we've got this under control, or we've managed to live with it, or, you know, We will work out a way. And a lot of times these viruses, which in the beginning are very vicious, they kind of run out of steam eventually. So I don't think that we should think that, oh, well, what Italy was in March is what we've all got to look forward to till the end of time. We're just going to have to learn to deal with it and then go back to the old normal, because I'd really like the old normal back. I'd like my rights back. I'd like to go to, you know, Italy during summer. Don't really want to stay in Australia.
Right.
Want to be able to receive international post. So we need to get back to it. So I refuse to use new normal.
I'll quote my old friend and much more conservative friend, Tim Blair, who just sitting around the kitchen bench one night just looked me in the eye and said to me, "All change is bad."
I can actually see him do that, actually.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. So,
but look, we're going to finish up very soon. Look, there's got to be some sort of blowback on this stuff. Otherwise, we are going to have a massive disaster. We're involved in business. We're involved in a wide range of community activities out there. And I just see a disaster just going to smack us in the face in the next 6 months.
Yep. And we want to.
Is people realise the cost, and it may be a bit too late, but still. Yeah.
It's still electorally popular. You look at the hardline stance that Palaszczuk is taking up here, and most people love it. It's like, what the hell?
It's terrifying.
The tide. Yeah.
I've got to finish up soon. It's great to see you fellows on. It's good to see you, Joe. Good to see you, Caroline. Good to see you, Steve. Having a great conversation. I know some of you were talking a little bit better. I thought you might have had a bit of red wine under the table there. This is the second best conversation I've ever had. So I'd like to thank you for that. Just work a little bit harder for the next
week. It's episode two, though, isn't it? Hang on.
Noted.
And then, anyway, next week we've got our truth talking coming up. And also today I interviewed Gillian Kilby, who is chair of the Daily Telegraph's Rural Advisory Committee. We've got the Bush Summit coming up on Friday in Cooma. And the Prime Minister and several ministers plus the Premier and that are going to be there too. So I look forward to that, because we'll all be social distancing, but we'll be locked in the same hotel. So I'll have a great conversation with them. Anyway, thanks for your time. Thanks for everything. Thank you, my special guest. Good night.
Great to see you, mate. Thanks.